Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
An old quip about the Defense Department is that the Navy, Army, and Marines all have their own air forces. Throw in the Air Force itself and you've got a lot of flying assets. Yet DoD can be surprisingly vague in how it expresses the cost of flight and how to interpret it. The RAND Corporation looked into this and came up with some recommendations for an activity that costs billions every year. Joining me with more, Michael Boyto, Senior Cost Analyst at RAND. Mr. Boyto, great to have you on.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be with you this morning.
I'm surprised, I guess, that they don't really know across the different armed services how much it does cost them or how to account for the cost of flight, which I'm presuming is a billions and billions dollar tab every year.
I think they do know, but the way of capturing or expressing the cost can differ, and that was the focus of our study, was to come up with a standard way of expressing these costs.
So give us an example of how the same thing could be expressed two different ways and sound different.
First of all, a quick definition. When we're talking about these operating and support costs in the Department of Defense, we mean the cost to operate and support the aircraft after DoD has already paid to develop and procure it. And there are a whole bunch of different elements that are considered in the operating and support costs. Typically, a real big one is the cost of the squadron-level personnel. That would include crew and maintenance and other staff personnel. So that would be a big one. Another one would be fuel. So there are all sorts of different costs relating to operating and support of aircraft. And sometimes only certain of those elements are captured in a cost per flying hour metric, for example. And probably the most common use of that term, cost per flying hour, in the Defense Department is for the flying hour program for each military service. And that's an area that is well-defined for the cost per flying hour program. That's a peacetime program, and it's the hours needed to train air crews for them to achieve proficiency and safety in operating their aircraft. And the training requirements are based either on a number of flights or a number of training events, and this is translated into flying hours. Well, for that measure of operating and support costs, the Defense Department has very specific guidance about which cost elements are included. And so for that program, at least, those costs are pretty much apples to apples across different aircraft platforms. But in other usages, for example, when decision makers are looking at the cost of aircraft programs, say across services, and doing this to compare them or make decisions about their financial performance over time, there's not always a consistent metric or measure of the operating and support costs that are used.
Michael Boyto is a senior cost analyst at RAND. And what are some of the recommendations you came up with for DoD, and how would they support better budgeting and better understanding of the programs?
We looked at several different metrics that would be suitable, and we recommend two for capturing operating and support costs. And one is the cost per flying hour metric, and the other is a cost per aircraft per year metric. And they're sort of complementary, and each of them gets at a different aspect of military value. And the cost per flying hour tells you, as the name implies, the operating and support cost to fly that aircraft for an hour. And that's one value that an aircraft presents to the Defense Department, is flying it for missions. But there's also another value that is, I think, unique to the Defense Department, and that's the value just in having a force structure. And by that, I mean an aircraft with an air crew that's trained and ready to perform its mission. Weapon systems like that have a deterrent value, and that's important in the Department of Defense, too. And in fact, we hope that these aircraft never have to be flown in combat, that just the deterrent value alone will be sufficient to deter aggression. Unfortunately, that's not always the case. But these two metrics are complementary in that respect. The cost per flying hour metric gets more at the cost of actually operating the aircraft, whereas the cost per aircraft metric gets more at its a value in its force structure. Another reason for this complementary metric of cost per aircraft is that cost per flying hour can actually be confusing. It has some fixed costs in it. These operating and support costs, some of those costs are fixed, and the maintenance personnel are a good example of this. They're typically a large cost in the Defense Department operating in support of aircraft, and they're largely fixed or insensitive to the amount of flying that's done. And so if you reduce the number of flying hours for a fleet, the total operating and support cost can go down, but because the flying hours, which are in the denominator of that metric, also go down, the cost per flying hour metric can increase, even though total ONS costs are decreasing. So it's kind of a counterintuitive result for a measure of financial performance. And so for that reason, the cost per aircraft metric is complementary. In other words, when total ONS costs go up, the cost per aircraft metric also goes up. And so it's more a more intuitive result.
And so have these recommendations been presented to DOD, and does it look like something that the financial powers that be there look like they would like to adopt?
We have published the report. I have to say that I think in many instances they do look at cost per aircraft already. One example of a big well-known program where we hope the recommendations get applied would be the F-35 or Joint
Strike Fighter. I knew you were going to say
program.
That one.
Right. Yeah, it's the largest acquisition program in the Defense Department. And, of course, it's been criticized for cost growth in every phase of its life cycle, including the operating and support life cycle. And the program is actively and rigorously looking at ways to reduce its cost, including reducing its operating and support costs. And one of the ways that military programs can do that is to make more use of simulators for training rather than actual flying. And what this does is, since there are fewer flying hours, just like I mentioned, the total operating and support cost for the fleet can go down, but the cost per flying hour can go up when you reduce the number of flying hours. And so if decision makers, either in the Defense Department or in Congress, are looking at that metric, they could get the wrong impression that costs are going the wrong way, whereas if they also consider a cost per aircraft metric, it will move in the right direction. In other words, if the program is able to reduce its operating and support costs, the cost per aircraft per year will go down, and the metric will better reflect the success that the program is having.
Michael Boydo is Senior Cost Analyst at RAND Corporation. Thank you so much for that explanation.
All right. Thanks, Thomas. Great talking with you.
Find a link to his report and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. Listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Defense Department is consolidating management of services contracts. This comes as a much-awaited policy instruction. The goal of the policy is to put more expert employees in charge of services procurement. But not everyone is convinced DOD did it in the best way possible. Federal News Radio's reporter Scott Massioni has the story.
Industry and government have been waiting a long time for the Defense Department to change the way it procures services. That's because services are tricky to buy. DOD buys more than $150 billion worth of services a year. Those come in the form of medical services, IT, construction, and maintenance. What makes services procurement tricky is they can't be easily stacked into a single program like hardware procurement can. Here's Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Andrew Hunter, to explain.
It's spread all over the place. It's not housed, unlike what you see with hardware, where you get a handful of these very large programs that make up a pretty large chunk of the spending that goes on. Every base is contracting for services, all across the world. And so you find that service contracts, including in some cases pretty large service contracts, are being let in a lot of different places with varying degrees of expertise of the people who are actually doing the work. And so, as I mentioned, the fact that it's diverse, diffuse, and decentralized is true, it's not necessarily a problem, but it has led to problems when you've had people doing the work who maybe weren't really trained and equipped to do that. You know, they may have, you know, gotten the commander of an office at an installation because of their great, you know, record in combat, but then, you know, now they're suddenly responsible for a multi-hundreds of million dollar service contract, and that's an unfamiliar spot to be in.
DoD's new policy is an attempt to consolidate the way services contracts are procured so buyers can make more informed decisions. The department did this by creating functional domain experts, or FEDs, to head specific services contract portfolios and make better buying decisions. Here's DoD's Director of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Strategy at a National Contract Management Association event.
If you have a functional domain expert, you have somebody who oversees a portfolio of services, who has unique insights and can develop unique insights into that particular segment of the market. That person can look cross-cutting across the department and look at opportunities created by redundancies, look at best practices, look at what metrics make sense for that particular functional domain. One size does not fit all in metrics. Just because it's a service instead of a product does not mean the same metrics are going to be relevant to what you're looking at in that particular marketplace. Doesn't mean you have the same behaviors or market structure just because you're a service. So looking at a functional domain expert to have that cross-cutting look across community feel to how we're buying services is a critical part of how we're tackling these.
Grady says DoD will be keeping a close eye on the metrics the FEDs develop because as experts, they will know what metrics matter most. The policy also adds another position called component level heads, or CLLs. CLLs will act as liaisons between the FEDs and defense components. CLLs will also assist in overseeing the lifecycle of a service contract and promote the training of program managers. Here's Hunter again on the new positions DoD's added.
I think this is a real step forward. As I mentioned, you know, part of the insight that led to this instruction to begin with is the idea that acquiring services is not the same as acquiring hardware. And so the goal with this instruction is to recognize that and to lay out procedures that are specific to the unique challenges of buying services. What I would say with these functional domain experts is it's taking that insight to the next level, which is to say that not all services are the same either. And that, you know, acquiring construction services, acquiring knowledge-based services, acquiring sustainment, complex sustainment services, and complying, getting more simplistic services acquired are all very different exercises, and it requires different kinds of expertise to do it. And that's where I think these functional domain experts are really a recognition of that and a big step forward.
However, not everyone thinks DoD's changes will work as well as planned. Vice President at the Lexington Institute, Dan Gouray, says DoD is adding more bureaucracy into an overly bureaucratic system.
You've now added not one, but two layers of bureaucracy in addition, in an effort to simplify and speed up the process. We have an overly complicated system. This does really nothing to simplify it. It just rearranges deck chairs, you know, on the Carnival cruise liner. And we expect things to get better because we're inserting more, if you will, middle management. Never works. So I doubt it. I honestly doubt that this will work. It's an attempt to circumvent what is sort of the more obvious problem, which is an overly complex burden with regulations and requirement system. And, you know, occasionally you can have somebody who can help somebody wend their way, you know, through the labyrinth, but it's not as easy as these people think.
As for who might be filling the FED positions, Gray says DoD has a balancing act to deal with. The department needs someone who is not too entrenched in government as to not understand the services industry, but it also needs someone that is savvy enough in government procurement to understand DoD's process. Here's Gouray again.
It's sort of like the crossbreed between a horse and a donkey. What you get is a sterile mule. In a sense, what you really like in your domain expert is somebody who understands both sides. That's really hard. And so it's not clear that you could find somebody, if it's the government person, that they actually understand industry. They may understand government. They may understand regulations, right? They've been through the Defense Acquisition College, which is all about government approach, the government side of contracting for everything. Or they're coming from really senior from the services part of a private sector, the contractor. Then the question question is, you know, how much do they know about and understand the way government functions? They probably understand demand function very well, you know, and how to provide services, but do they understand the ins and outs of government? It ought to be a team, honestly.
DoD's new policy also sets up a services requirement review board to review and validate requirements for contracts worth $10 million or more. Here's Grady again to explain.
This is people sometimes call it contract court. This isn't about contracting. This is about requirements. This is about, have we looked at it? Is this a smart way to meet our needs? Have we looked at it, and is it redundant to any other capabilities? Is there a more efficient way to address that? Is that really the highest priority from a services perspective? Ken Brennan, who works for me, who's in charge of services acquisition, he likes to joke that anybody who has a dollar and a willing contracting officer can get a service contract. There's some truth to that in an absolute way. So this is looking across portfolios and saying, okay, how do we really plan to spend our money on services? And is that really the highest priorities for those organizations? It's not mandated cuts. It's not an arbitrary reduction. This is, does this make sense to proceed with this requirement? And in some cases, what we're finding is some people, when they look at their requirements, think about, well, maybe this isn't quite as important as something another office really needs. And there's some self-correcting behavior due to visibility associated with those requirements, is what I would say. And also it's creating visibility for opportunities of where it makes sense to potentially combine some requirements.
Andrew Hunter told Federal News Radio that the review boards are central to the whole effort. It's a way to hold contractors accountable and reduces duplicative acquisitions. Hunter also says the boards serve as quality assurance and work to serve as a comparison on where DoD is getting good deals on contracts and where it's not. Finally, the new policy follows a trend Congress started by delegating more acquisition power to the services. Military acquisition chiefs will have authority approval over service contracts worth more than $1 billion. From Washington, Scott Massioni, FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM.
Share this story with colleagues. Go to FederalNewsRadio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at FederalNewsRadio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.